Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across Northern British Columbia. Our podcast is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program that the Specialist Services Committee, which is a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation from local health authorities. We are casting to you today from the traditional territory of the Kleidlay-Tenay First Nation. And hosting today's episode are Dr. Sheer Chewy and myself, Deanna Danskin.
In this episode, we're talking about a topic which is every practicing clinician seems to have an opinion on, whether good or bad. Healthcare IT systems and electronic medical records, or EMRs. Over the last few decades, we've seen a massive expansion in the number and reach of these IT systems into every aspect of medicine and across our entire healthcare infrastructure. And although bringing benefits to the care we provide to our patients, a new IT system somehow always seems to receive a mixed reception from frontline clinical staff. Here to talk to us today about healthcare IT and EMRs, our guest is Dr. Bill Clifford. Bill is that rare combination of both physician and software developer, previously awarded the Order of BC for his leadership work as the now retired Chief Medical Information Officer for Northern Health and creator of the highly ranked electronic medical record, MOES. Welcome to the show, Bill. It's great to have you with us today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So let's start with some background about yourself before we get started talking about all things EMR. So can you tell us a little bit more about sort of where you grew up and your journey into becoming a physician?
Sure. Yeah, I took a bit of a circuitous route before I was 4 years old to get to Prince George, where I lived all through to and high school. And so that was a great place to grow up in the 60s and 70s, and decided to go to university, to University of British Columbia, to do forestry. Actually, I decided to go to do oceanography, but then so you want to be in the ocean or you want to be in the bush. Being in the bush won out with respect to forest ecology, and the forest ecology piece actually is relevant to this story ultimately, which we'll get into in terms of system view. And then went off to do a master's degree at University of New Brunswick in system modeling and a bunch of things of that nature. And then my colleagues in high school who went through med school while I was at UBC got me interested in medicine. So I actually even used to sit in on some of their anatomy sessions. So that was niggling in the background, and I figured that, by the time I was almost 30, I better do something or I'm going to be too old. So I applied thinking it would take a couple of years to get in, and I got in the first year in to Memorial, and the rest is history.
That's very interesting. Yes, very circuitous route, but definitely would provide a good background in things around systems, all that ecology stuff. So now reflecting on your career in the software end of things, how did this unusual marriage of medicine and computing originally develop in your career?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the whole ecological system thinking was a big deal in my university experience. And in my postgraduate experience, it got raised up on steroids, if you will, with modeling. And so I worked on the first simulation model, the first operational simulation model for determining sustainable yield. Now, the basis of which I think is still in use, behind what's in use around the world at the moment, actually. So that was pretty bleeding edge at the time. And it was a very gratifying experience and something that I really sort of was torn. My going away party, they gave me permission to sit out in the parking lot and decide whether I really wanted to, all the gifts and the go away. But anyway, I did throw in the towel and went off to med school. And then, through med school, you're so busy, you're fighting fires all the time, on call. But in the residency program, the subsequent residency program, which I did in Manitoba, I had more time to think about stuff, about charting and about care and follow-up and coordination. And it started to really frustrate me using paper records. And this was in 1986. So there wasn't an awful lot of examples to turn to say, oh yeah, if we did it that way with the computer, it would be better. And not in the same way that there's, I could point to a whole bunch of examples on, hey, if we did forestry or ecology this way, it would be way better. I did end up doing my mandatory research project on terminology subsets for implementation in electronic medical record. You know, like this was so geeky. I did get an award for it, and I'm not bragging. I'm actually just pointing out, I think I got the award because it completely baffled people. They thought it was something really cool. They weren't quite sure, but they didn't want to discourage it. So anyway, so that was what got me going. And it didn't take me very long in actual practice and coming to Prince George after I'd worked in a few other places in the late 1980s to think I've got to get an electronic medical record and I better start doing it now. So I started writing my own in 1989. Which went live in 1990 early. So it didn't take long. It wasn't a full EMR, but it was the starting the framework of one at that time.
So what was your driving force that sort of influenced you to decide to create your own version of an electronic medical record, which later became MOIS? So we're talking about MOIS a few times in this this episode, mm-hmm. which stands for Medical Office Information System. So what motivated you to move forward in those extremely challenging times?
Yes, well, of course, I have a primary care background and did full service family medicine for more than a decade. And in that is a whole host of things that are really useful to be able to do, which people in the 60s recognized. And that's things like panel management, like who in your practice who has diabetes, I mean, it's sort of the almost trite now, diabetes versus COPD, who's getting the appropriate care for those things? And to do that with a paper chart was more an exercise in sampling than it was in knowing the entire population, so you leave no one behind. So all you would end up with in those days were people collecting a big pile of charts, and I know our residents did in the late 1990s, that you would see these big honking piles of charts before the chart content got matured in the electronic system. And they were doing their research project or their practice improvement project and asking about what the sample rate should be. And sometimes I would be able to do this on my own. I had, of course, the more data, the more in the group practice that I was in. And I remember one poor resident was working on colorectal screening. And he had collected all this stuff, and I'd already written a program to do this, and I could recognize whether the person had a colonoscopy and whether they had their fecal occult blood and all the rest of it. And I said, "Oh yeah, that's a real big problem. I think you should try to look at all the charts." And then he kind of looked at me, and he went and he looked back, and I ran to my office. Like I just sort of sauntered out nonchalant, but as soon as the door closed, or I ran to my office and I ran the report. It took me about maybe 8 minutes. And I came back and I said, well, if you looked in our practice, this is what it would look like. Anyway, that was a bit of fun. But it really made the point, I think to him, he did go on to do lots of really good stuff in family medicine. Well, so that the obvious advantage for computer systems, I think, were even by then, were starting to become quite apparent. Just how to do it was not so apparent.
Oh, thanks for that. I mean, that in many ways is a great history lesson. But I wonder whether we could fast forward now to the present day and change tack a little bit, because modern medicine nowadays, we seem to be inundated with multiple different electronic medical record and data systems, and each one has their own clinical domain. And can you tell us, I mean, how do these actually contribute to improving the quality of the care we provide to our patients? You mentioned a little bit about being able to track data and track patients a little bit more effectively. But can you give us some practical examples of how care quality is actually improved by these systems?
Sure. Well, there's quite a few things that are actually lost in the literature today where people are railing about how the EMR is causing burnout and taking away too much time and all these things. Things that we've taken for granted for some time now. So you're starting with the really basic without having a physical chart. I tell you, the workflow of moving around a chart is huge. And many people who are newly graduated and say in the last 5 to 10 years probably aren't even haven't ever experienced that. In Northern Health, there was a large group practice of 18 full-time equivalent physicians. They had a very large staff of people, almost matching the number or 1.5 times the number of doctors. And it was a two-story clinic with no elevator. And there were two extremely fit people whose only task was to move charts around. They were super fit. Like, I was totally impressed. So they looked like they worked out in a gym every day because they were going up and down the stairs with these bundles of charts. And then the people were yelling all the time because the patient had come in unexpectedly the next day, but the chart was somewhere, or they'd just come in for a normal visit, a normal scheduled visit, and nobody could find the chart. Some doctor had tucked it away or it got lost somewhere in the big pile of to do a medical legal report. So that's a significant thing. And of course, in the hospital, how many times have I looked for a chart only to find that somebody had it, including a nursing student who at one point who has had the pile of charts to do her end of day report sitting in the stairwell with these things, trying to get ready so she wouldn't flunk or whatever, or she wouldn't look bad to her preceptor. But everybody rushing around trying to find the chart. So then there's the processes of care, especially in community offices, like the inbox. I remember when all of the lab tests came in on flimsy paper, you know, the part of a carbon copy. Blue ones were for chemistry, red ones were for hematology, yellow ones were for urine and other things. And your staff had to go to the hospital, pick it up out of your inbox, out of your hospital inbox, bring it back, put it on, attach it to all your charts, and you went through this. There is no way that that is faster and easier than with a computer today. If the inbox, and now some people listening to this will be raging, wishing they could reach out and throttle me for saying these things because they may not be having that experience. But I would argue that that experience is from the functionality of the EMR that they're using. It may be things like, and here we are back to the 1990s, trying to make the electronic paper record so that it matches what you were used to with paper, where you pull up the document and you keep doing this, as opposed to seeing a list of discrete results that you can go through extremely fast that aren't attached charts that you're pulling off and putting away, writing things on it. You're right-clicking, sending something to your MOA saying, please recall. And it's instantly on your MOA's desk and nobody's moving their chart around. So that kind of stuff is I don't think people remember too much about the history unless you've got as many gray or as few gray hairs as I have. I have very few gray hairs. I just won't mention I have very few hairs.
You're absolutely right, Bill. People look back in the past with rose-tinted glasses and just assume things were better. But you just reminded me about the time when I used to read radiology or film, right? And that was incredibly cumbersome. It could only be in one place at one time, and it was never where you needed it, right? So it was incredibly frustrating at times. So you're absolutely right. And I wonder whether you could just talk a little bit about with all the current IT systems and each with their clinical domain, what are the current challenges then that healthcare organizations face regarding these healthcare systems? And is it possible for a universal EMR to exist? Does it exist yet? Or is that something that we aspire to still?
I think some people have it in mind because of all the problems that we're having by not having a single universal EMR. So it's a very natural human tendency to say, hey, well, let's just have one system, because in their mind, the one system will solve everything. But then that leads to all what we've just referred to before about functionality. So I would actually put functionality as almost the number one list to consider. So it's not it's interoperability, privacy, security, and functionality. So I was going to mention in the previous comments to your question about all of the different data systems, think of integrated scheduling, billing, and notes functionality, e-referral consult loop, clinical decision support that you get with drug allergy and drug-drug interactions. And then I briefly mentioned before panel management. So that aspect of practice that lies with not with the patients in the room, but patients are out there for which you're in your panel, and you still have an obligation to be looking at their wellness, gaps in care, and all the rest. So we do have this challenge of having good functionality for all of those features. And I'm not sure that any one system does that well, but there's not any one system that does anything else that's common in our society, like point of care sales and all the rest of it. One of the reasons why it just keeps getting better is we have diversity, and different people have different magic sauce to bring the functionality up. Similarly, and because there's so many different kind of focused areas, like say consultant practice versus primary care practice versus allied health specialty services in the community versus hospitals themselves and all that goes on in the hospital, it kind of makes sense to have some products that are focused and good at those areas, and yet through interoperability can make the information all seamless and virtually one. And one of the options for that virtually one, if there is going to be such a thing as a universal EMR, might be the personal health record, not the electronic records that providers are using, because they've got their business, and I'm using that, their healthcare business and their specific needs. So the point of care sale system in an online bookstore is probably a lot different than a hardware store in some respects. At least maybe some vendors have made it better. Well, the same for the provider, but patients are the universal connector because they're the center of all of this. Now, I'm currently involved in a project that seeks to not make one monolithic personal health record for patients to use and see the results and operate their processes, like making appointments, messaging, being part of the team. But do it in a way, again, through the interoperability. So they essentially the personal health record becomes like all the other records. It has interoperability requirements and specifications to be able to pull the information from your primary care office, from your consultant office, from the health gateway in British Columbia setting, and from the hospital systems, and have an integrated view of everything. And either download it so you have it in a secure way, or you pull it as you need it. There's offline issues. Anyway, we won't get into all those details. So I think functionality is key, and the diversity of functionality and its development, and then interoperability is the number one issue right now today that's disrupting processes, no matter how good these individual systems are, because you have incomplete information. And you're not able to interact with each other, like a referring physician and the consultant, and the reply back and forth, and the messaging that goes back with associated with it, like, would you please send me a clinical summary and a care plan for this, and responsibility for appointment, so we don't end up with the Greg's Wings scenario. So I think that's the key here to not having one system, but having this interoperability. And privacy and security is always a concern, but the good news about that is, even though it is a huge domain, it's similar in construct and even in solution to everything else in the system. I mean, here, look at all the breaches we keep hearing about. It's not just limited to health. It's growing in health because people are starting to see the value in it. But all systems now need to have the appropriate kinds of security. Sorry, that was a long-winded discussion
No,
of this.
that's okay, Bill. It's all interesting, but and I'm just interested to know. I mean, how close are we to interoperability? I mean, it strikes me that building interoperability is going to be like, the United Nations getting everyone to agree on the on the same principles and one common platform. I mean, how what's the way forward look like, and how close are we?
Well, very good question. Well, I think on the interoperability point, there's a huge amount of experience around the world on doing it and doing it well. There's a host of systems or things that have been with what's called Health Level 7 that have evolved over time to this so-called FHIR, which is spelled FHIR, Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources, that allows for the actual physical exchange of information in an organized way. But combine that with information modeling, like has been around since the 1990s, called one of the most significant of which is Open EHR, or Open Air sometimes it's pronounced. And it's gone through multiple layers of development internationally, eventually settled from, went, moved from France to Australia in terms of the headquarters of the nonprofit organization, but it's used all over the place, especially in South America, Europe. It's formed a standard for the European Union.
That's interesting. Well, that does sound like hope on the horizon. I'm going to skip the next question, question eight, but I'm going to hand it back to Diana to carry on with question nine. Is that
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, sounds good. I feel like we've discussed all the challenges and reasons that implementations are challenging. So just moving on to the topic that seems to be a real hot topic these days, artificial intelligence in healthcare. So either machine learning or large language models. So how do you see the use of these affecting the practice of medicine in the foreseeable future? And what's your vision of the benefits that they can potentially bring to the quality of patient care?
Think of AI as like writing code to do an EMR was in 1989, right? So it was exciting. The possibilities were immense. The amount of work, though, to make it go well was also immense, right? And I think that we're in the same here. The opportunities for AI are already around us. There's things happening right now that are working. And sure, I remember, you know, we were talking about I was saying that radiology, the use of AI or radiology interpretation was more like pattern recognition, and which is AI. You got to learn, it's artificial intelligence to learn how to do pattern. But we know that deep learning would also include, with respect to interpreting films, knowing the full context, having a very good understanding of what went on with the clinician that ordered the test in the first place, not the one-liner that you hope to get and the reason for the study, right? You're somebody with a lumbar x-ray, not that that should ever be routine, but for whatever reason it's come to that. And not only is there a good history of the back pain, but there's also the AI knows that this person has a past history of prostate cancer. So, you know, that's putting together a lot of information to help focus in on what to look for. And so there's been problems with getting the connections. This is complex work. And I look at some of the criticisms of AI and how many mistakes that some of the systems that are being made, because the deep learning hasn't gone deep enough yet, maybe one part of it. But the second part of it goes back to our original conversation about poor data sets, structured data, and all of that stuff. We have really lousy data. I had to refrain from doing something that you would have to cut, but really bad data. saying something you have to cut. So that compromises the speed of the learning and the depth of the learning and the accuracy. So we've got issues. But however, having said that, some really exciting stuff that's going on, like ambient artificial intelligence to listen to the conversation between provider and patient and be able to then summarize, make an accurate summation of that encounter and add that to the progress notes. Now, again, double-edged sword. If that happens, but it doesn't happen coincident with structured information from that encounter back into its proper place in the record following the information model and the standards that we just talked about, then there's a risk that we go back to an electronic paper record, nicely done by AI. The most beautiful notes that anybody's ever seen. But one that is going to need more AI to figure out what was done in a structured way.
Fascinating and very, very exciting. Yeah, I kind of like how you kind of put it back. It's sort of like how things were back in the 80s, but just an extremely different set of technology that we have available now. So we're just going to move to a little bit of a different topic now. So a question we ask all of our guests, just reflecting on your career, what do you like most about living and working in BC? You said you spent a lot of your career in Prince George, and I believe you're on Vancouver Island now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. What do you like about BC? Practicing, living,
Well, you know, I started the conversation with talking about a circuitous route to Prince George, and I had a circuitous route to come back to the north, and specifically to Prince George as well, by working in other areas, including spending a bit of time in Kenya and working in other provinces, and then here ultimately. And you know, certainly I feel like it was the best decision I made in my life to come back to BC, and specifically, you know, in general, but to Prince George specifically. The medical community in Prince George, I think to this day, continues to be quite close-knit. It is still the only large system, a large community system, where the family physicians do most of the primary care hospital work. Hasn't succumbed to hospitalists yet. And for the benefit for that being integration of care, but also think back to the early days of working there, being a full service, juggling obstetrics with eMERGE shifts and all the rest of it. We had the doctor's lounge and we got to know each other. We had quarter consults were huge. Like, who needs race when you can stumble out of the doctor's lounge at 2 a.m. after delivering a baby? Oh, there's the internist that you needed to talk to about that patient you're going to see tomorrow. And then, of course, for me as well, the geography here is unbeatable. So I've been on the East Coast. I've lived there for a long time. I've lived in the middle. And I have to say this is the greatest combination of mountains, ocean, forest, ice, and no snow in the winter.
Oh, don't say that, Bill. It's pretty cold up here at the moment. But I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. It's a great medical community up here, and it's different. It's very different from others, and it is close knit and continues to be close knit. It is a great place to work. Well, thank you for those insights, Bill. But unfortunately, we have actually run out of time now and have to bring the interview to a close. So it just remains me to thank you for coming and having a super chat about healthcare IT. I think it's been wonderful. As a token of our thanks, we're going to send you one of our exclusive and highly coveted Quality Cast North coffee mugs. And if you, the listener, would like to find out more about today's guest or this topic, you can find out more information on the show notes on our website, which is www.nhpqi.ca/podcast, where you'll also find links to our other episodes. And if you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe to our channel on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. But until next time, we've got to say goodbye from your host here at Quality Cast North. I'm Cher Chewy.
I'm Deanna Danskin.
And thank you, Bill.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was great chatting.
Today's episode was hosted and co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Deanna Danskin, with technical support from Matt Walker. Original music by Daniel Chewy and artistic support by Reggie Goodine. Further information on the content of today's episode is available with the show notes on our website, nhpqi.ca. Quality Cast North is recorded on the traditional territory of the Clayclaytonais First Nation. If you enjoyed today's interview, check out our other episodes available on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you find your podcasts.